Good afternoon, and welcome one and all. There are some records which seem to arrive carrying their own atmosphere. A few notes can suggest a distant place, a particular season, or simply that quiet feeling when the day begins to soften. The seven recordings in this program do that in very different ways. Some come from films, some from the popular charts, and others show what could be achieved when a singer, an arranger, and a small group of musicians understood one another perfectly. These are compact records, most lasting little more than 3 minutes, yet each creates a complete world within that time. That economy was one of the great skills of the period. The mood, arrangement, and instrumental detail all had to work immediately. We begin with a voice admired for its steadiness, its warmth, and its remarkable control. This is Joe Stafford, accompanied by Paul Weston and his orchestra, with You Belong to Me.
Darling, all the while you belong to me. See the marketplace in old Algiers. Send me photographs and souvenirs. Just remember when a dream appears.
Stafford recorded You Belong to Me in 1952 with the orchestral accompaniment provided by Paul Weston, who was also her husband. The song had already attracted several singers, but Stafford's calm, unforced delivery gave it a special quality. She never appears to strain for an effect. Instead, the melody unfolds with the ease of someone speaking clearly and directly across a room. The record became one of the defining successes of her career. It reached the top of the American charts and also became the first recording by a female singer to lead the Young British Singles Chart. That was quite an achievement at a time when the formal weekly record chart in Britain was still a new idea. Mrs. Stafford had begun as a member of the Pied Pipers before establishing herself as a solo artist, and the discipline of close harmony singing remained part of her musical character. Her timing was exact, her diction was immaculate, yet nothing sounded cold or over-rehearsed. Our next singer brought together a rather different set of influences. Born in Paris to Italian parents, Caterina Valente became an international star who could move easily between languages and musical styles. With Werner Müller and his orchestra, here is The Breeze and I. Breeze and I began life as Andalusia, written by the Cuban composer Ernesto Lecuona as part of his Andalusia suite. English words later transformed it into The Breeze and I, though the strong Latin character of the original music remained. Caterina Valente recorded this version in the mid-1950s with Werner Müller's orchestra. It became one of her most important international successes, reaching the upper part of the British chart and helping to establish her with English-speaking audiences. Her performance has brightness and precision, but also a freedom in the phrasing which reflects her background in cabaret, jazz, and continental popular music. Werner Müller was especially skilled at producing colorful arrangements without allowing an orchestra to become heavy. Listen to the way the rhythm keeps moving beneath the vocal line, while the brass and strings add flashes of color around it. The arrangement creates heat and movement, yet Valente remains completely at ease above it. Ms. Valente herself was also an accomplished guitarist, and her musicianship is apparent in the confidence with which she meets the orchestra's rhythmic turns. Nothing sounds tentative. Singer and arrangement move together, giving the performance the lift of a live appearance while retaining the finish of a carefully made studio record. A song can travel from one country to another, change language, and still retain its identity. It can also travel from the cinema into popular memory, sometimes becoming far more famous than the film for which it was written. That certainly happened with our next selection, which is Les Baxter, his chorus and orchestra, with Unchained Melody. Was written by composer Alex North and lyricist Hai Zaret for the 1955 film Unchained. The film concerned a man serving a prison sentence, and the song expressed his longing for the life and the person waiting beyond the prison walls. Several recordings appeared almost at once. Les Baxter approached it not as an intimate solo ballad, but as a broad orchestral and choral piece. His version rose to the top of the American chart and was also successful in Britain. The voices are used almost as another orchestral section, swelling around the melody rather than telling the story through a single singer. Baxter understood how to make a short, popular record sound expansive. He used changes of volume, masked voices, and rich orchestral color to suggest something on a much larger scale. It is a very different interpretation from the later versions most people remember, and that difference is precisely what makes it worth hearing. The cinema remains with us for the next piece, but the setting changes from confinement to Venice. David Rose and his orchestra play Summertime in Venice.
Thank you. love's promised land, there'll be no one but you for me.
Be My Love was written by Nicholas Brodsky and Sammy Kahn for the 1950 film The Toast of New Orleans. Mario Lanza sang it in the film with Catherine Grayson, and his commercial recording was made with Ray Sinatra conducting and the Jeff Alexander Chorus. The record became Lanza's first million seller. It demonstrated why he appealed to listeners who might never have attended an opera. He brought the power and sustained line of a trained tenor into a popular song lasting only a few minutes. The arrangement begins with a certain formality, but the intensity steadily increases until the final phrases seem almost too large for the recording studio. Lanza's career on film was comparatively brief, yet his records introduced operatic singing to an enormous popular audience. He did not dilute the voice to suit popular music. Instead, the orchestra, chorus, and microphone were arranged around the voice he already had. From that great flood of sound, we move to almost the smallest accompaniment possible. This is Julie London, with Barney Kessel on guitar and Ray Leatherwood on bass, and the wonderful Cry Me a River.
You can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head, while you never shed a tear. Remember, I remember all that you said. Told me love was too plebeian. Told me you were through with me. And now you say you love me. Well, just to prove you do, come on and cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. I cried a river over you.
Arthur Hamilton wrote Cry Me a River, and Julie London recorded it in 1955 for her first album, Julie Is Her Name. producer Bobby Troup made the decisive choice to use only Barney Kessel's guitar and Ray Leatherwood's double bass behind her. That sparse setting was perfectly suited to London's intimate style. There is nowhere for the singer to hide, but there is also nothing competing with her. Kessel places each chord carefully. Leatherwood provides a quiet pulse, and Miss London sings close to the microphone with a restrained delivery that makes every word seem deliberate. The recording became her signature performance and was later selected for the United States National Recording Registry. Its strength lies partly in what the musicians leave out. After the large orchestras and choruses heard earlier, this record reminds us that atmosphere can be created by silence and space as effectively as by massed strings. And now it is nearly time for Albert to join you with this week's Gardening Notes. His program has its own unhurried pace and friendly companionship, and I know that many listeners value the time spent with him as he shares his extraordinary wealth of knowledge. He will be here as soon as our final record has finished. And so we close with a pianist and composer whose elegant playing had been familiar since the swing era. Eddie Heywood wrote Soft Summer Breeze, and his 1956 Mercury recording became a substantial American chart success. It is relaxed, melodic, and entirely appropriate for the last days of high summer.
Hello, Hugh. Hello, everyone. It's good to be with you. Well, I hope the garden has given you something to enjoy this week. At this point in August, you can go outside with one job in mind and come back with a basket you hadn't planned to fill. A few beans catch your eye, then a courgette, and before long you've forgotten what you went out there to do in the first place. If you grow potatoes, you may now be wondering whether some of them are ready. Second early varieties are often lifted during July and August, while most main crop potatoes are better left until later. The difficulty, of course, is that the crop is underground and gives us very few clues of the stage it's reached. Rather than lifting a whole row to find out, choose one plant and gently move a little soil away from the side. If the potatoes are still smaller than you'd like, cover them again and give them more time. If they're a useful size, you can lift that plant completely and see what it's produced. Push the fork into the soil well away from the stems and lift slowly. Then use your hands to find the potatoes left behind. There is nearly always one sitting just beyond the place where you thought the plant ended, so carry out a thorough search. Any potato cut by the fork or marked by a slug should be put aside and used first. The sound ones can be kept somewhere cool and dark until you need them. Do keep them out of the light, because light can turn the skins green, and green potatoes should not be eaten. Second early crops are at their best when they're fresh, so there's no great advantage in storing them for long. Brush off the loose soil, let the skins dry, and take them into the kitchen as you need them. And if that first plant gives you only a modest handful, don't be disappointed. It has still turned one seed potato into several. I still think that's rather marvellous, don't you? Now, if you're growing sweet corn, this may be the week when you begin looking at the cobs and wondering whether they're ready. The first sign is usually the silky tassel at the end. When that has turned brown and dry, the cob may be ripe, but it's worth checking before you pick it. Peel back just a small part of the husk at the tip and press one of the kernels with your thumbnail. If the liquid is clear, the cob needs more time. If it is milky, the corn is ready. If it has become thick and doughy, the cob has probably gone a little beyond its sweetest stage. If it isn't ready, fold the husk back over the kernels and leave it on the plant for a few more days. There's no need to open the whole cob. When the time comes, hold the cob firmly, pull it downwards and give it a twist. It should come away quite easily. Pick only what you're likely to use that day, because sweet corn begins losing some of its sweetness once it's been removed from the plant. That is why home-grown sweet corn can be such a treat. It doesn't have to spend hours travelling or waiting on a shelf. It can go from the garden to the saucepan while it is still wonderfully fresh. You may find that the cobs on the outside of the group ripen before those in the middle, or that one plant is ready while the next isn't. Check them individually, rather than assuming the whole patch will be ready together. And watch the birds visiting your garden, because they sometimes discover a ripe cob before we do. If the husks are being pulled apart or pecked, a piece of netting held safely away from the plants may help, but make sure it is stretched tightly enough that birds cannot become trapped. Once you've tasted a cob picked at just the right moment, you'll understand why gardeners check them so often. We're not being impatient. We're simply trying not to miss the best day to pick this delicious crop. You know, herbs can be wonderfully generous at this time of year. A small plant bought in spring may now have filled its pot, leaned over the path and begun offering far more leaves than you can use at once. To keep basil producing, take the tips of the shoots rather than picking single leaves from the bottom. Cut just above a pair of leaves and the plant will usually branch from that point. If flower buds are forming, and you want more leaves, pinch the buds out before they open. Use basil fresh when you can. If there's more than you need, you might like to turn it into a sauce or pesto and freeze it in small portions. The leaves themselves can darken when frozen, but the flavour is still useful in cooking. Mint is even less likely to wait for an invitation. Pick the young tips regularly and it will keep making fresh growth. The leaves can be frozen whole or chopped and frozen in an ice cube tray with a little water. Then you can take out one cube at a time when you want it. Oregano and marjoram are both good herbs for drying. Cut a few healthy sprigs, tie them in a loose bunch, and hang them somewhere dry, shaded, and airy. Once the leaves feel crisp, rub them from the stems and keep them in a clean jar. Don't cut every stem from a plant. Leave it enough leafy growth to carry on, and leave some flowers too if the bees are still visiting them. We can take what we need without clearing the plant completely. This is also a useful moment to look at herbs growing in pots. Mint, in particular, can fill a container so tightly that water runs around the edge without reaching the middle. If the plant looks tired even after watering, it may be badly congested. You can divide it later, but for now, setting the pot in a shallow tray of water for a short while may help the root ball become evenly moist again. There is a great deal of pleasure in storing a little of the herb garden for later. Open a jar of dried oregano in winter, or crumble a few mint leaves into a drink, and the scent brings summer back before you've even tasted it. If you have a rose that flowered once in a great rush earlier in the summer and has since sent out long, flexible stems, it may be a rambler. Late summer is the time to give rambling roses their routine prune. Do make sure it is a rambler before you begin. A climbing rose usually continues flowering through much of the summer and is normally pruned in winter. A rambler tends to give one main display, often around June, and then puts its strength into new stems. Before you cut anything, stand back and look for those fresh new stems. They're the growth you want to keep and train, because they will carry flowers in the future. If the rose has covered its support and become crowded, remove 1 in 3 of the oldest stems right down at the base. The oldest ones are usually thicker, darker, and less flexible. In a smaller space, you may choose to remove the stems that have flowered to replace them with the new growth. Wear stout gloves and long sleeves and take one stem at a time. A rambler can hold on to you from several directions at once, and remember, there's no prize for trying to untangle the whole plant in one movement. Once an old stem has been removed, guide one of the new stems into the space and tie it loosely to the support. Fanning the stems out, or training them more horizontally, helps to spread the flowers, rather than allowing everything to gather at the top. Shorten the smaller side shoots on the stems you keep by about 2/3. Remove anything dead, damaged, or rubbing badly against another branch. If the rose has attractive hips and plenty of room, you may decide to leave some of them. Routine pruning is not about stripping the plant bare. It's about making space for new growth and keeping the rose securely attached to its support. Work slowly, step back now and then, and stop when the plant has room to breathe. It should still look like a rose that knows where it wants to go, only now it has a little help in getting there. If you have a pond in your garden, late summer can leave it looking rather crowded. Water plants have been growing strongly, leaves are beginning to yellow, and blanket weed may be gathering in the warmer water. Start gently. Remove yellowing leaves and any flowers that have clearly finished, but don't clear everything away at once. A pond is home to far more than the plants we can see, and a sudden tidy-up can disturb creatures that are using them for cover. Blanket weed can be lifted by winding it slowly around a rough stick or gathered with a net. Check it as you go and return any pond creatures you find to the water. Then leave the weed beside the pond for a day or two before putting it on the compost heap. Anything still hidden in it has a chance to crawl back into the water. Duckweed also can be skimmed from the surface with a net. You won't remove every piece, mind you, but that's all right. The aim is to stop it covering the whole pond, not to make the water look scrubbed clean. Try to keep a reasonable area of open water. If vigorous plants are taking over, trim them carefully rather than pulling at their roots. Around half the surface being open allows light and air into the water while still leaving shelter for wildlife. The water level may also have dropped in warm weather. Rainwater from a water butt is ideal for topping up if you have one. If you have, add the water gradually, especially in a small pond, so the temperature does not change too suddenly. In hot, still weather, a fountain or pump can help keep the water oxygenated. If you have one, check that the inlet is clear and that the flow hasn't become weak. Afterwards, leave the pond in peace and watch it for a while. A dragonfly may return to the same stem, a water boatman may appear at the surface, or something may move beneath a lily leaf. The pond doesn't need to be perfectly tidy. It only needs enough room for life to carry on. Thank you. early apples may now be beginning to ripen, and you may have noticed the first sound-looking fruits on the ground beneath the tree. A windfall can be a sign that the crop is nearly ready, but check the fruit on the tree rather than picking everything at once. Cup an apple in your hand, lift it gently and give it a slight twist. If it comes away easily with the stalk attached, it is ready. If you have to tug, leave it for a little longer. Apples on the sunny side of the tree may ripen before those in the shade, so you may need to pick the same tree several times. That's better than taking the whole crop before the flavour has properly developed. Early apples are usually meant to be eaten fairly soon after picking. They may be crisp and delicious when immediately they are harvested, but many of them don't store very well for long periods. Keep them somewhere cool, and it's best to use them within a few days. Handle them carefully. A bruise may not show immediately, but it can soon turn into a soft patch. Put damaged fruit and windfalls aside for cooking, and keep only sound apples in the fruit bowl. Also, do look before reaching into the branches. Wasps are often drawn to damaged or overripe fruit, and may be feeding where you cannot see them at first. And if the tree is on the tall side, don't stretch from the top of an uncertain ladder. A proper fruit picker is safer, or you can wait for the fruit to fall and use it promptly. Do not put yourself at risk of falling off your ladder. There's no need to polish every apple until it looks like one from a shop. A little uneven colour or a harmless mark is part of having grown it yourself. The important thing is that it is sound, ripe and tastes as it should. And perhaps that is enough for this week. One apple picked at the right moment, eaten slowly, with no need to do anything else for at least a minute or two or five. Before I go, do remember to take a little time to enjoy your garden as it is now. Late summer never stays with us for quite as long as we hope it will. The evenings begin to draw in almost without our noticing, and the light across the garden takes on a softer look. There will always be another job waiting, but it needn't all be done today. Leave something for tomorrow and give yourself a chance to enjoy all of the results from all the work that you've already done. I hope the coming week brings you something good from your garden, whether that's an apple, a few herbs, or simply a quiet place to sit for a while. Bye-bye for now, and please take good care of yourselves.